This one?
You're now recording.
That's Brian, does he need to turn anything on for you?
Or is, all right, he's good to go.
Great.
Is that on?
We're supposed to do an introduction, but Mark's going to introduce himself.
This is Mark. That's fine. That'll work. That's right. Good deal. I didn't bring my coffee up here to the podium. It probably would go away. I wouldn't stay here anyway, but definitely recognize that coffee goes very well, strong coffee in particular, goes very well with archaeology, right? And starting the day with a little bit of archaeology is always challenging, particularly on an undergraduate campus. We use lots of slides, lots of pictures, and there's nothing quite like walking into the classroom, turning out all of the lights, you know, at 8 o'clock in the morning. It's not a good recipe. But I know you have lots of coffee, and you are ready to go. I was a little apprehensive when invited to come to this conference, as was suggested maybe in some of our conversations ahead of time. I come to you from Central Florida. I think it was 80 degrees when I got on the plane, and coming here to Central Nebraska in November, you know, I was a little apprehensive. I couldn't remember the last time I actually wore socks. And I figured that all of you would be wearing them, and pants too, you know, pants as well. But, you know, Florida is a great place to live as long as you don't mind mosquitoes and Zika virus and hurricanes and senior citizens on the highways and, you know, all that kind of stuff. At least we don't worry about ties and socks in Florida, which is a very good thing. Anyway. Why am I saying all of that? Thanks to John, thanks to Steve, thanks to York College and all of the people who have gone out of their way already to make us feel at home. I appreciate it. I know before these 2 days are over that all of you will appreciate that as well. Just because I may not have enough time to say it at the end, I want to say this now. I brought a few things. You know how we are in this gig. I brought a few things, set them at the end of the table, have a look-see at the break time, a couple of books that may be of interest to you. What doesn't cost you anything, however, is to go and visit the website. I've got a website that I advertise all sorts of nonsense on and communicate all kinds of things there. A lot of it has to do with story. I like to paint pictures with words, tell stories about our adventures in the ancient Near East and in the lands of the Bible. And so we tell stories there. We also offer resources, and all of our college courses are up there, the syllabi and all that kind of thing. If you care to Kype something, please feel free to do that, because everything I have, I Kype from somebody else. Anyway, I've not ever had an original thought in my life. Yeah, anyway. You can also subscribe there, and if you do, I promise not to pester you. I teach as an adjunct in Israel with the Jerusalem Center for Biblical Studies, and what that offers me is an opportunity to take my own students as well as church groups overseas on a regular basis. We do probably 6 or 8 trips a year. I spend at least 2 months every year over there. We try to have a good time. We try to, incidentally, also give people an opportunity to interact with archaeology and the Bible in ways that sometimes local guides don't provide, because they do not share our priorities. I say that not necessarily knocking these guys, but just because I think I have a better sense of what your values are as both teachers, educators, ministers, and if you're interested, here's the commercial. If you're interested in that sort of thing, you can always come and talk to me. I've got several sample brochures over there on the table as well, which describe some of the trips we're doing for different colleges and universities as well as churches. Okay, enough of that. Enough of that stuff. All right, here we go. Let's see. Top 10. That's right. Top 10. Top 10 lists always grab attention, especially when they're devoted to archaeological finds. Social media is awash with news of discoveries that prove or disprove the Bible. I really wish I had a nickel for every time I get a foreword about chariot wheels at the bottom of the Red Sea, or some really, you know, cool imagery of Goliath's head complete with the rock, you know, in the forehead. You know, it's irresistible stuff, isn't it? You have to agree with me. Irresistible. If nothing else, though, it offers us, it makes your time standing in the supermarket checkout lane go a little quicker, right? At least we can, agree on that. This morning, however, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to give you a top 10 list or even really fool around with the latest archaeological reports or tabloid reports, if you will, as entertaining as that might be. Since this is a serious academic conference, right, with some serious academicians, my aim here this morning will be directed at some less tangible stuff. So let me cast the net for you broadly and see if we can't pull it in. You ready? Here we go. I aim to provoke thinking about the rise and fall of the biblical archaeology movement and to reflect upon the status of the discipline today. I'm going to contend that despite great gains, the biblical archaeology movement of the 20th century stumbled, and there are many reasons. Among them, expectations ran ahead of results. But I will also contend that the discipline is far from dead. A revised agenda suggests to us that biblical archaeology has a lively future. My presentation is going to take the shape of a python that has swallowed a small cow. We start at, yeah, that got your attention, didn't it? We start at the head and we discuss the reported death of the biblical archaeology movement and consider some of the reasons that have been offered to explain it. Following this, we move to the large and lumpy body. And here we consider the birth of the biblical archaeology movement, glancing at what it believed, what it promised, and what it delivered. And finally, as we get to the skinny tail, we want to ruminate over where all of this leads us today. My hope is that our talk here will spill over into the hallways and into the dinner tables. I like what John was talking about when he said our intimate meeting. We have plenty of opportunities to discuss these things, and that your collective dialogue, your voices added to mine, will increase the value of the total experience. I am sure that in a room like this one, that I am not the only one who has an opinion, right? So we look forward to that. The last thing that we're going to say while we're still kind of stretching out here, getting started, I want you to be on the lookout for some themes in our little talk. They're kind of like the leg lumps, you know, on the torso of our python. One theme is going to center on the struggle to define the phrase biblical archaeology, or the phrase biblical archaeology movement in America. A second theme is going to highlight the presence of the Christian church or Church of Christ people in the narrative. This is a story that's really waiting to be told. I keep chewing the possibilities of turning this into an article for somebody. If I were to say four C's, would you know what I'm talking about? The four C movement, Christian church, Church of Christ, the four C's or four C folk. When I say that, I'm talking about restoration movement types. Okay, of all flavors, and I'm certain we have a few flavors right here. The point of all of this is that we have skin in the game, and somebody really needs to tell that story. And so I'm going to try and bring in a few names here and there. If I overlook somebody, I really hope that you'll bring it to my attention so that as I continue to collect my my hit list here, I'll be able to augment my own work. A third theme that we're going to dance with, really just kind of tangentially on the side, has to do with popular archaeology or archaeological reports. While it may be difficult for those who are not swimming in the discipline every day to evaluate what we call headline archaeology, I believe that it is possible to become a more proficient and cautious consumer of archaeological claims. I must say that the need for this has probably never been greater, as filtered and filterless news about biblical discoveries is everywhere, even on my Facebook page, which I'm not looking at right now because I'm so irritated by it. Anyway, that's another story that I don't need to do right now. So let's get started. And as I suggested to you, we're going to start at the end and kind of, you know, work our way backward, the death of a discipline. A few years ago, I was appointed a fellow at the Albright Institute in Jerusalem. Now, for those of you who don't know, the Albright is the focal point of the American archaeological effort in Israel-Palestine. And it is, in many ways, the birthplace of the biblical archaeology movement. And each year, the fellows dialogue and do research and share presentations. We fuss a little and visit the sites that are in the region. Back in 2011, which was my last appointment, the island of Cyprus ended up on our agenda. And boy, oh boy, was I pumped. Yeah, Cyprus. Ooh. As it turned out, Bill Deaver was also in Cyprus at that time. And so we gave Bill a call, and two of us went over and paid him a visit in his summer home there, not far from Nicosia. Now, Bill is one of the senior statesmen of archaeological research in the Middle East, having directed excavations for many years at the site of Gezer. That's Bill there in the middle beside the guy with the flannel shirt or the plaid shirt, and that's his wife, his former wife, on his left. Bill directed excavations for many years and led the archaeological institute there at the Albright in Jerusalem. Retired, he still publishes and thunders at conferences and from time to time appears on those archaeology television shows, you know, the obligatory Easter and Christmas special that we always have. I use Bill Deaver as a lead here for a couple of reasons. First, what many folk don't know is that he is the product of the Restoration Movement. He graduated from Milligan College in Tennessee, and his father taught at Lincoln Christian University, the home to many uncanny and swarthy professors. At least that's what Bob would have us all to believe. Sadly, in the case of Bill, advanced study with some very good people, and in this you should read G. Ernest Wright at Harvard Divinity School, did not lead him in the direction of a faith commitment, but rather away from it. And apologists like us need to take notice. The conclusion that more study, even more archaeological study, leads to more faith is not necessarily true. The persuasive power of archaeology can be easily overstated. And in case you haven't noticed, we are complex creatures indeed. Witness our national political process. Anyway, I said I wasn't going to go there, and then I did again. I am one of Bill's students in an indirect kind of way. He was the primary teacher of my primary teacher. So on that evening there in Cyprus, while the warm sun was setting, we spent time telling stories and having some laughs. I even managed to recruit him to write the foreword for a memorial volume that I was working on at the time. It was dedicated to a former professor, an archaeological geologist, who taught at the Cincinnati Christian University for many years. He also happened to be Bill's geological consultant. Bill had to participate in the volume. Well, at least that's what I said. And eventually he said, yeah, this is a good thing. I remember him saying that specifically. And I was happy because Bill was at one time part of us. Now, allow me to, you know, offer a footnote here. Bill was also the teacher of this guy. I don't know if you recognize the face. That's Dale Manor, professor of archaeology at Harding University. And I understand Dale was here on the campus of York. He emailed me, three weeks ago, and said he had just been here to York. It's a fine place. Make sure to see the museum. Dale said it's a great place. Dale is presently the field director at the excavations at Bet Shemesh in Israel, and our own Frank Wheeler here in our midst works there along with him. I don't know, is there anybody else in the team here that's a part of your group?
Not here.
Not here. But on the campus maybe, perhaps of York? I don't know. No. You're the guy. Okay. Excellent. It's good to have you here with us. So that's one reason why I lead with Bill. A second reason why I lead with the image of Bill Deaver is because of an article that he wrote for Biblical Archaeology Review back in 1995 titled "The Death of a Discipline." It was conceived as an obituary for the biblical archaeology movement in America. The obituary detailed what many of us were sensing at the tail end of the 20th century. The discipline was in trouble. And several reasons were offered to explain that. Here are six, distilled by me and cast here in the present tense. Biblical archaeology was in trouble because, first, the practice of archaeology is too expensive. At least it's becoming too expensive, too specialized. I don't know about Bet Shemesh, but the dig that I was a part of was hitting six figures on the budget every summer for just one season, 6 weeks worth of digging. Very expensive. Number two, funding agencies such as the National Endowment for the Humanities and the National Geographic Society are drying up. Very difficult to get that money. Number three, American colleges and universities are cutting humanities programs in favor of what administrators and probably not so few parents believe to be more practical career paths. Number four, church groups, religious schools, and seminaries that used to sponsor a majority of digs in the region are now becoming rare birds. Footnote number one. Number five, national schools in Israel and Jordan and Turkey have come of age. They are no longer requiring our outside help. Westerners like us are no longer needed. Truth of the matter is, Westerners like us are stretched to keep up with the locals these days. And number six, according to Deaver's little article, political turmoil in the Middle East makes everything just a little more difficult. These reasons were offered to explain the end of an era, or in Bill's words, the death of a discipline. Now, there's no doubt that he had his teeth into some meat here, but I still don't believe he chewed it all the way to the bone. So let me try. The 20th century enterprise known as the biblical archaeology movement in America stumbled for many reasons. First, it promised more than it could deliver. And second, it lost its faith in objectivity. Now, if you're into philosophical terms, you can blame the positivists for the former and the postmodernists for the latter. I'll circle back around to these before we're all done. The consortium of universities and schools known as the American Schools of Oriental Research, or ASOR, got this message loud and clear. For 60 years, they had published popular articles in a magazine titled Biblical Archaeologist. In 1999, despite a vote by 80% of its readership against the move, the name of the magazine was changed. The biblical part was dropped, and it became the more benign Near Eastern Archaeology. Clearly, the obituary was read, at least among the elites in the country. Postscript, in an interview that was aired by Nova in 2008, Bill Deaver said these words, "The truth of the matter today is that archaeology raises more questions about the historicity of the Hebrew Bible and even the New Testament than it provides answers. And that's very disturbing to some people." Well, I consider myself disturbed. You may feel the same. So if 1999 was an end point of sorts, and I'm still not prepared to say the death of a discipline, it does beg the question, when and how did the biblical archaeology movement in America begin? Who were its original movers and shakers? And what principles, promises, and methodologies guided them? Let's back up and consider the birth of a discipline. You guys with me so far? My intent, coffee's work. My intent is to wow you with pictures, you know, so you don't look at me and you don't really listen to what I say. You say, "Oh, that's pretty," right? You know, okay, all right. Good. Well, holler, you know, please interrupt me anywhere along the way. I'll stop reading. The birth of a discipline. The earliest archaeologists were treasure hunters and robbers and adventurers, and they sought objects from the past because of the value of the objects themselves, apart from context, apart from history, and apart from the Bible. Gold is, after all, gold. Other archaeologists, if we can call them that, particularly those in the Bible lands, were treasure hunters of a different order. In this case, the treasures that they sought were assessed in a whole other realm. They were after religious realia, or relics. And the value of these objects rested in their connection with the Bible and with faith. Think for just a moment of all of the quests, you know, in this way. The true cross, the Holy Grail, the Ark of the Covenant, you know, all that Indiana Jonesy stuff. I must say the union demands that we show at least one screenshot from the Raiders of the Lost Ark in every presentation. It's union, right? In thinking about realia, don't overlook sites and the geographical features as well. These, too, link faith with physicality. The location of the stable where Jesus was born, the place where he grew up and was baptized, transfigured, resurrected. Pilgrims walked these trails looking at the landscape through eyes of faith, and they wrote down their experiences. They built chapels to mark select spots and to make it possible for others to share in the experience of collected memory, or collective memory. As a single example, consider a snippet from one of the earliest pilgrim accounts, that of Egeria. This Spanish nun visited the Bible lands in the 380s. Man, that's early, right? Late 4th century, and recorded her visit. Her diary has been partially preserved, and we can read her notes. And we watch as we read and we see how she looks around the land with biblical eyes and worships and weeps. Just listen for the emotion as she reports visiting the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. Here she shares the experience of place and text for the worshiping community. And then the bishop, standing within the rails, takes the book of the gospel and proceeding to the door, himself reads the narrative of the resurrection of the Lord. And when the reading is begun, there is so great a moaning and groaning among all, with so many tears, that the hardest of heart might be moved to tears for all that the Lord, for that the Lord has done, has borne, can't read, such things for us. This is most certainly the starting point for biblical archaeology. The quest for realia. And we understand the motive. Christianity, from the very beginning, was a historical and a text-oriented movement. Why, didn't the Apostle Peter himself muster an argument on the day of Pentecost with a trowel in one hand? And he said, "We have two tombs that are with us to this day, the tomb of David and the tomb of Christ. One is empty, the other is not." This quest for realia and the reopening of the Bible lands in the 18th and 19th centuries laid the foundation for modern investigation. Here, there are more players than we have time to note. Napoleon and his Egyptian expedition, Edward Robinson, Kitchener and Condor, and the Royal Engineers, and of course, David Roberts. In light of our theme, I prefer to zoom past these more familiar players in order to mention the explorations of one Dr. James T. Barclay. Barclay was the first official missionary of the 4C folk. Barclay also happened to be a physician. And through relationships of trust, both with Jews and Muslims, he was able to visit sites off limits to ordinary pilgrims. While his church plant there in Jerusalem did not take lasting root, Barclay did do a remarkable job of offering humanitarian aid to a suffering population and in giving close study to the remains of 19th century Jerusalem. His legacy is measured in part by a volume that was published in 1857, The City of the Great King. Notice the subtitle as well. Barclay brought a humble image of the state of affairs of the East to an audience in the West that was hungry for news from the land of our Savior. As a further aside, if you visit the historic Cathedral of St. George in East Jerusalem today, you can find Barclay and his wife mentioned in a panel under a stained glass depiction of Christ's baptism. And here you can see the window that I'm describing. And if you look down below, here's the panel underneath. It's probably not an accident that in this very ecumenical cathedral, the one Church of Christ guy on the wall is linked to the practice of immersion. I thought you'd like that. Another early explorer and leader from the 4C folk was J.W. McGarvey. He taught for nearly half a century in what is called the Lexington Theological Seminary in Lexington, Kentucky. Like Barclay, he was an associate and student of Alexander Campbell. And as a result of notes taken by Barclay during his travels in the Mediterranean in 1879, one of the earliest systematic surveys of the lands of the Bible was published. Lands of the Bible, as it was titled, presents a glimpse of life in the late 19th century, and its prose reaches our ears as a bit tedious and argumentative. I guess that's what makes him a good 4C guy. By McGarvey's day, the map was littered with sites. Bethlehem, Nazareth, Jerusalem, they were all there. But it was still a two-dimensional world crafted on the basis of local tradition, word of mouth, and classical sources like Origen and Eusebius. All of this would soon change in the hands of the biblical archaeologists. And they came from the West, from places like Great Britain and Germany and France and the United States. And they brought with them their Bibles and their shovels and their compasses, and in the case of many, a stout Protestant frame of mind. They were skeptical of local traditions and eager to scratch down to the truth on the other side of smoky candlelight. These founding fathers discovered two principles that would guide the practice of archaeological excavation throughout the 20th century. The first of these was the practice of stratigraphy. This idea was developed in coordination with the geological sciences. It seized upon the idea that sediments were laid across the ground and over time in layers, newer ones over older ones. Some of the layers were natural, consisting of wind-borne or water-borne, wind-blown or water-borne sediments. Others were the product of human effort, consisting of mud brick, stone, wood, and ash. And these natural and man-made layers mingled and accumulated. And in this way, ruin mounds, or tells, as they would come to be known in the Bible lands, were formed. Tells like this one, Tell Bet Shan, dotted the landscape. As a note of interest, recognize that the earliest explorers did not, perhaps they could not, distinguish tell sites from natural hills. The famous explorer, Edward Robinson, stood on top of Tell Tanakh in 1852, and there he observed how this place had a great view and would indeed present a splendid site for a city. However, he went on to write, there is no trace of any kind to show that a city ever stood there. Ironically, the site that he sought rested beneath the tread of his own boots. Time has a way of turning busy cities into silent mounds. First recognition of tells as layered ruins is sometimes attributed to Heinrich Schliemann. In the decade of the 1870s, he initiated excavations at the site of Hisarlik in Turkey, and his quest was Homer's Troy and the treasures of Troy. Schliemann was untrained. His tactics were frightening, and what he actually understood about archaeology is questionable at best. Contemporary assessments of his work often use labels like savage and brutal. More informed ideas about tell and site formation were brought into the field in Palestine at a site known as Tell El Hesi, which you can see here. At this place, an American archaeologist and son of a preacher by the name of Frederick Bliss worked with the great Egyptology master Flinders Petrie. And under Petrie's guidance, Bliss cut a chunk out of the side of Hesi. This is what it looked like near the time of excavation. And here's what Bliss's cut looks like today. The excavations were promptly published in 1894, and Bliss made use of the stratigraphic principle explicit in the title. El Hesi was not a mound of a singular city, but indeed the mound or a mound of many cities. Bliss nailed it. And we can only imagine the process of site formation. The natural attractions that brought the first group of people to a place, fertile fields, water, an elevated position, a highway, a strategic regional center, etc., etc. These features attracted other folk as well. People built, modified, destroyed, built, modified, destroyed, built, modified, destroyed, over and over again on the same spot. And don't forget this, the remains of each of these settlements consisted of basically the same materials. Mud and stone over mud and stone over mud and stone. Many excavators like to use the analogy of the palimpsest when describing multi-period sites. A palimpsest is a recycled manuscript. Because of the value of writing materials in antiquity, a parchment or a page that had writing on it could be erased and reused. The old ink was washed or scraped off, and a new text was written right over the top of the old one. The problem here, as you can guess, and as you see in the example of Greek over Hebrew, this one's Hebrew over Greek. That's the way it ought to be, right? Hebrew over Greek. Yeah. The problem with this is that the old text can never be fully erased. And we suspected that already because we've seen CSI on TV, and we know that your tracks can never be completely covered, right? The same is true for these tell inhabitants. When examined closely, you can see that the wall lines or streets of a new settlement may obscure but not totally erase the lines of the old. Consider this two-phase drawing here from Tell Megiddo. The layout on the left is older, going back perhaps to the time of Solomon. The layout on the right is more recent, dating to the Assyrian period. Notice how apart from the perimeter wall, the gate complex, which you see over here, the gate complex, yeah, there, the water system down here, right? And, you know, of course, the perimeter wall. Apart from some of these features, nearly everything else has been moved. The tell was completely rewritten, if you want to use the palimpsest analogy. Sometimes the levels, the ancients leveled the place, dumped fill in the gaps, and started over. Other times they pulled up the old stones and reused them. In these kinds of haphazard ways, the heaps of human debris accumulated. The principle seems obvious today, but it was revolutionary at the start of the 20th century, and it guided how excavation techniques would develop in the decades that followed. Digging a mound was visualized as the act of peeling an onion, you know, one layer at a time. All that had to be done is to reverse the process of accumulation. And of course, we mustn't forget that archaeology is one of the few disciplines where you begin at the top of your field. Just saying. Initially, excavators moved tons of material by arranging the diggers in a row, and they bulldozed right across the top of the site. Those who found objects were rewarded with cash prizes or bakshish. It had all of the frenzy of an Easter egg hunt. But it also became obvious that this business of digging stratigraphically was easier to imagine than it was to practice. It simply couldn't be done with herds of unskilled workers. One set of eyes could not supervise 100 set of hands. Closer control and organization was needed. A tell was not an onion. And scientific excavations were not an Easter egg hunt. Sorry about all the mixed metaphors. Experiments in digging both deep and wide were attempted. After several false starts, the discipline settled on a tactic called the bulk debris method, otherwise known as the Wheeler-Kenyon method, after two British archaeologists of the 1950s. Not Frank Wheeler, although... Mortimer? Square holes were dug, leaving unexcavated soil walls, or bulks, standing between each of them. The bulks provided guidance to the diggers and left a physical memory just in case something was missed. When I was taught to dig a square, I was told to imagine that I was draining a pool. Follow the layers, they said. Keep it level, they said. Write everything down, they said. One thing became clear to me. Archaeology is not a repeatable science. There are no do-overs in this game. Once a square is dug, there's nothing left but a hole. Think about it. Excavation is the act of controlled demolition. People say to me sometimes, oh, it must be exciting to be an archaeologist. Yeah, I reply, but, you know, even bullwhipping Nazis and jumping snakes gets old after a while. Truth is, the work is more like that of an outside librarian. Lots of careful observing, describing, note-taking, and recording is necessary. Of course, here and there we do get to do some heavy lifting. But let's get back to the birth, right, of biblical archaeology. A second principle discovered by the founding fathers was the principle of seriation. Like stratigraphy, this principle guided the practice of excavation through the 20th century. And again, the biblical archaeologists were the people who led the way. Even though the idea of site stratigraphy arrived early in the 20th century, the ability to assign fixed dates to excavated layers or strata was problematic. A tool for establishing a relative chronology was ready to use, but no one had done the hard work of figuring it out. Several pioneers voiced the thought that the humble potsherd might be a clue to the chronological puzzle. Clay vessels were, after all, the Tupperware of the ancient world. Their production shapes were often changed, so they were time-stamped. Once fired, they were almost indestructible, and their pieces, or potsherds as we call them, were scattered throughout the layers of these biblical period tells. But what would their contribution be, and how could it be measured? It wasn't until the work of William Foxwell Albright that the value of the humble potsherd was fully recognized. Now, I don't suppose it's any different than recognizing that the taillights of a 1959 Cadillac are very different than that of a 2012 Mazda. But instead of taillights, Albright studied the form and finish of pots and bowls and jugs and jars. And then he took his knowledge to the field and assigned specific ceramic forms to specific stratigraphic layers. And this combination proved to be the ticket. For the first time, archaeologists had a chronological tool that could be cross-checked and refined by the study of other sites. The discipline was put on its legs, and Albright became the father of biblical archaeology. And students of the field from the 1930s into the present day must devote themselves to the learning of the sherds. In retrospect, the gifts of site stratigraphy and ceramic seriation were the most important methodological contributions of the biblical archaeology movement. But what we must also be careful to note is that this generation of men and women did not give themselves to the study of antiquity for the sake of study alone. In Albright's case, he was reared on the mission field in a devout evangelical home. His first love was biblical studies and biblical languages. Archaeology was simply a venue through which the text could be explored in a new way. The same was true of G. Ernest Wright, Albright's student and successor. G. Ernest was more vocal than Albright in matters of faith. He was a pastor and the son of a pastor. I recognize a theme there. Professionally, he taught at the divinity schools of Harvard and McCormick, and there became a bit of an expert in two oddly paired areas, biblical theology and ancient pots. He was as fluent in dispensational covenants as he was in loop handles and pointy bases. He also founded the magazine that we referred to earlier, The Biblical Archaeologist, and as we noted, was also the teacher of Bill Deaver, Small World. Later in life, Wright described what he did in these words. The biblical archaeologist, therefore, studies the results of the excavations in order to glean from them every fact that throws a direct, indirect, or even diffused light upon the Bible. This definition could have easily fallen from the lips of Albright himself. It suggests that this lively discipline is bigger than the search for realia alone. It also suggests that the practice involves filtering and interpreting, or to use the biblical metaphor that Wright used, gleaning. We pick up scraps in the field, like Ruth gleaned behind the harvesters of Boaz. To really feel this definition, we must consider the wider intellectual context. Many of Albright's and Wright's contemporaries doubted the face value of the biblical text and were frankly unimpressed by all this newfangled archaeology stuff. The latest and greatest angle of biblical study coming out of pre-war Germany was Formgeschichte, or form criticism. This approach placed very little value in history per se, and instead was more interested in getting behind the biblical text in order to discover its roots in some sort of oral tradition. In the hands of the German school, Formgeschichte was quite influential during the first half of the 20th century. Albright and Wright viewed archaeology as a way to bring objectivity to an unsteady table. It was a scientific tool capable of producing real facts to push against manufactured interpretations. In 1958, an article titled Archaeology and the Old Testament Studies, G. Ernest Wright echoed the teaching of his mentor and claimed that archaeology is objective, whereas biblical criticism is subjective. This kicked the beehive in Germany, where scholars like Martin Note shot back, "Oh yeah?" Well, sort of, but that's my own reading of it. I didn't do very well in theological German. Better put, Note asked the question, is archaeology truly external and objective? The birth of the biblical archaeology movement in America must be understood against this backdrop. Hot buttons for Albright and Wright touched on issues in the debate with the biblical critics. These included the historicity of the patriarchs, Joshua's campaigns in Canaan, and the reality of the Old Testament kingdoms of Israel and Judah. And while many aspects of the biblical story are not testable in the dirt, these particular issues seem to be ripe with promise. The American school gave them full attention, further improving digging techniques and interpreting the scraps they found in light of the biblical text. Under Albright and Wright's leadership, the American school aggressively pursued site excavation, regional survey, and archaeological present publication. As Tom Davis has pointed out, for them, the potsherd became the new realia. And in this vein, one other thing must be noted. While there was an apologetic edge to their work, we ought not to make the mistake of believing these founding fathers to be fundamentalists. As defined in the first half of the 20th century, a modernist often rejected the Bible as a trustworthy source. A conservative thought the Bible to be generally trustworthy, but produced by human hands. A fundamentalist accepted every word of the Bible literally and inspired. By these definitions, Albright was a conservative, and on occasion was not above condemning those who claimed, in his own words, the theory of verbal inspiration, sometimes miscalled a doctrine. While deeply interested in the story of spiritual development, remember Albright's most popular volume was titled From the Stone Age to Christianity. Albright did not air his personal faith. Like many men of his age, he was very private about such matters and instead considered himself to be a scientist, a linguist. Again, I rely on Davis, who wrote in his appraisal of the biblical archaeology movement. That was Tom Davis's bib right there. Tom Davis's work on the biblical archaeology movement. Albright was more concerned with what archaeology tells us about ourselves than what it tells us about God. Wright was more openly theological than his teacher, but again, no fundamentalist. He thought archaeology could enhance faith, but it was not really about proof. Israel functioned in an atmosphere of hope based on trust. Is our task any different? The conservative approaches of Albright and Wright left an enormous footprint in the discipline, particularly here in America. Behind their capable leadership, the consensus would veer strongly to the right. The 1950s saw an explosion of public interest in related publications. New discoveries in the world of texts, such as the Dead Sea Scrolls, right, 1948, 1949, added to the gravity and is a story that's beyond ours.
That guy wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls?
Yeah, he very talented man, very talented. Biblical archaeology, huh? Biblical archaeology was touted as a tool to illuminate, illustrate, and confirm the Bible. As a member of the baby boomer generation, that's what I grew up with, and I reckon that some of you did too. One could make the case that the apex of the biblical archaeology movement came in the middle of the 20th century. Perhaps no one voiced it as triumphantly as the Jewish archaeologist Nelson Glick, another of Albright's students, and the leader of the American school. He famously cast these words in 1956. It may be stated categorically that no archaeological discovery has ever controverted a biblical reference. Scores of archaeological findings have been made which confirm in clear outline or in exact detail historical statements of the Bible. And by the same token, proper evaluation of biblical descriptions has led to amazing discoveries. So I know what all of you in this room are thinking. How in the world do we get from this high point of the discipline in 1950s to Deaver's reading of its obituary just a half century later? And that's a good question. And if you've been a part of the academy, and here I say any academy, and maybe even any discipline, humanities or sciences, you can probably tell the story from your own back pocket. Such stories will illustrate the wider symptom of the day, the social forces that arose in the second half of the 20th century. In this case, an epistemological quandary showed itself as an erosion of confidence and the rise of a hermeneutic of suspicion. At the start of our talk, I suggested a couple of reasons for this staggering slide of the discipline of biblical archaeology in America. Let's start circling back to those reasons now and see how the second half of the 20th century played itself out. We've spent some time with Albright. I'll linger with him just a moment longer. By his own admission, Albright was a positivist, and from a philosophical perspective, this is probably the best way to describe him. Positivism is a technical term often used to describe someone who emphasizes an empirical approach. Albright was convinced that the past could be known by means of rational study. What's more, he believed that historians should formulate universal laws, like they do in the natural sciences, in order to explain the past. Albright was optimistic about the possibilities, believing that scholars were capable of true objectivity. They could rise above their own biases, see past their own noses and prejudices. He was also optimistic about the promise of scientific advances, suggesting that if science could be refined enough, if the machine could be dialed up just high enough and precisely enough, subjectivity would be displaced, logic would triumph, and the truth would emerge. That, my friends, is a positivist. If you're interested in reading more along these lines, I recommend Albright's biography, A 20th Century Genius, as well as Megan Moore's analysis of him in her Philosophy and Practices in Writing a History of Ancient Israel. For the rest of us, right, maybe for all of us, let's just simply remember that in the 1950s, we had just won a world war. We had split the atom. We had built an airplane that could fly faster than sound itself. For goodness sakes, we were prepared to go into outer space. Certainly, we could figure out how to dig a tell. Without a doubt, great gains were made in the first half of the 20th century using the principles of stratigraphy and seriation. Because of these, we discovered much about the deep past. We knew about lifeways of people long gone. We knew what they ate and how they lived and died and what they wore and what languages they used and how they traveled and with whom they traded and what commodities they used. Stratigraphy and seriation had given us many gifts, and yet both of these principles, as practiced, had hard limits. With respect to stratigraphy, the act of stripping layer after layer from a tell proved to be much more difficult than anybody imagined. I myself have dug through more than one packed earth floor. Don't tell anybody, please. And maybe even a mud brick wall or two. And I never knew it till I was through it. Maybe that's just me. Or maybe not. Stratigraphy worked well enough in simple situations, but the variables that produced tell sites are many. Apart from finding a jar smashed on a burnt floor surface, it's difficult to establish secure layers. Oddly enough, the forces within a tell itself seemingly cause material to shift and move of its own accord. And this includes our humble potsherd. The methodology believed to be the key for dating and demonstrating precise moments in time could not deliver that kind of precision. And what this meant is that those hot-button topics important to the founding fathers, the historicity of the patriarchs and Joshua's campaigns in Canaan and the kings of Israel and Judah, et cetera, these issues became problems. Here's the deal. The biblical archaeology movement promised proof of historical particulars, individual faces, unique acts. But the tools of archaeology were better suited for revealing anonymous generalities. The movement stumbled because it promised more than it could deliver. In the 1960s and 1970s, another academic debate, the attempt to cast soft sciences, hard science, came to a head. Soft science in this context is connected to fields like anthropology and sociology. Hard science, or the natural sciences, on the other hand, are connected to fields like physics or biology. Those who work in these fields usually have offices in different buildings on the campus, and that's not by accident. This soft science, hard science debate had nothing to do with biblical archaeology, at least initially. It was an issue for those practicing in the fields of North and South America. Those dealing with Native American materials were the first to double down on the rigorous use of scientific method. Much of this effort, however, in my humble opinion, did not go beyond the use of language. Fancy words were used to describe the digging of holes. Other attempts gained more traction, particularly those focused on process and human social development. Could genuine knowledge of human behavior be verified empirically? Could the practice of archaeology be tested and repeated so that an outcome could be projected? That's important because this predictive element, after all, is what makes science really science. Now stay with me. Don't get bogged down. I know. I'm going long. You okay? If you want to access this segment of the story, Google processual archaeology, or the new archaeology as it came to be known in the 1970s. And as a footnote, while you're at it, you might as well Google post-processual archaeology too, and realize that even as the birth of this perspective was celebrated by some, it was announced as dead on arrival by others. Needless to say, this push to become more scientific made its way across the Atlantic and Mediterranean seas. It was kind of like Columbus in reverse, going from the New World back to the Old. And those who practiced biblical archaeology in Bible lands, in the manner of Albright, were put on notice, and many took notice. They recognized that there was significant data at their fingertips that had been overlooked, and that there were ways of integrating data that had been ignored. So in the decade of the 70s, geologists, biologists, ethno-archaeologists, and environmental specialists of every stripe and flavor were added to field staffs. And they took their place at the lunch table beside the usual group of theologians and historians. Excavation teams at Gezer and Hesse in Israel and Heshbon in Jordan led the American charge. All of these were huge projects. They numbered 100 persons or more in a single season. However, unlike the ditch-digging gangs from the first half of the century, these groups consisted of pay-for-play students. You knew I had to work that in there somewhere. Interested church folk, lay people, and local muscle organized into manageable squads and led by experienced leaders. It should also be noted that by this point in time, Israeli projects from their own national schools matched the American projects head to head. The Jordanians weren't far behind. Budgets soared. Consortiums were formed to offset the budgets and to pay for the specialists. And the data began to pour in. So too the criticism. Incidentally, the criticism was not based on the addition of science to biblical archaeology per se, but rather on the positivist views that had driven it. Tensions also developed as the scope of study was broadened. New research questions about culture process and technology elbowed against old questions focused on answering specific Bible problems. This shifting emphasis may be noted in the archaeological reports and in the debates at the national or even regional academic meetings. In the reports, appendices were added to include not just traditional pottery drawings, but discussions of how these pots were made or from what clay sources they were drawn. Statistical analyses were added. The counting of animal bones, butchery patterns, regional geophysics, seed, and yes, pollen counts. Pollen! Carbon-14, not to mention studies of lifeways of local inhabitants. Certainly the challenge now was not just to excavate a mound, but to understand how the inhabitants of these mounds interacted with their, with the totality of the landscape. This was a far cry from the days of just picking up potsherds and other pretty goodies. It was all welcome information, of course. No one would deny that. But with this swamp of data, it quickly became obvious that no single person or single perspective could manage it all. There would never be another Albright. The day of the specialist had come. And with it, depending on the individual site, the voice of the theologian began to be lost. Frankly, with the flood of new material science, sampling methodologies, and new technologies, the theologians and historians felt less and less at home in the archaeological field. And yet they participated. Jesse Long from Lubbock Christian University co-directed the excavations at Kirbet Iskander in Jordan. John McRae and John Wilson, New Testament fellows from the Church of Christ, worked at Caesarea Maritima and Banias. Our own Frank Wheeler contributed mightily at Bethsaida before Bethshemesh? Yeah. Wilbur Fields from Ozark Christian helped lead Kirbet Nisha, which is where I got my start in the early 1980s. And there are so many more that we can't even list them all. Jerry Mattingly, John Wineland, et cetera, Reuben Bullard, and countless grad students and undergrad students. Other scholars assembled dig materials for the public. Here I think of Bill Humble or Farrell Jenkins or Jack Lewis. We have skin in the game, and other evangelical groups would say the same. But by the end of the 20th century, biblical archaeology as practiced had become much more ahistorical in approach, and at times even anti-historical. As a result, the discipline began a migration away from what had been its traditional drivers, departments of classics, history, and religion, to a focus within the realms of anthropology and sociology. Within some corners of the larger archaeological community, the influence of postmodernism was felt. In the 1980s and 1990s, it rocked the discipline. The effect of this questioned not only the objectivity of the investigator, but the objectivity of the entire enterprise. As the author of a book entitled Behavioral Archaeologists put it in 1987, the behavior of the archaeologist is the greatest source of variability in the archaeological record. See, it's all reflective. Postmodernism crushed the notion that the meaning of artifacts was stable or uniform. Instead, it suggested that the data has many voices, or put differently, data has whatever voice its interpreters give it. Hence, the way was paved for multiple readings of the same data set. The claim was made that biblical archaeology is just one of many subjective approaches. We could have gender archaeology, the archaeology of empire, urban archaeology, minimalist archaeology. All of these were equally valid, and perhaps even more so, since they were unchained from texts. Confidence was lost in truth, text, science, and even in our own objective selves. Hope was exchanged for cynicism. And as President-elect Donald Trump would say, believe me, that's the worst trade deal ever. I wrote all of this like in the last 2 weeks, which was probably a mistake, you know? It's no wonder that in 1995, Deaver threw his hands up in the air and he said, it's time for a funeral, people. Not only had the discipline envisioned by Albright and Wright been hijacked by partisans, so too the larger enterprise. In Deaver's words, if the actual history of the biblical world no longer matters, then archaeology is clearly irrelevant. Now that's a real Debbie Downer. Where do we go from here? The tale. 15 years have passed since Deaver wrote the obituary for Biblical Archaeology. And in that interval of time, some bad news and some good news has emerged. Since you are all already depressed, let me give you the bad news first. And here it is. The problems that Deaver listed have not gone away. If anything, they have intensified. Funding issues are greater than they've ever been before. Seminaries and religious schools are struggling to keep their heads above water and maintain viability in a shrinking market. Encouraging administrators to invest in an archaeological endeavor is a little bit like pushing a log chain. Pushing a log chain is what we used to say where I grew up. Archaeology is expensive, and the hot mess in the Middle East hasn't cooled much either. That doesn't help. The positivist perspective is seemingly gone, and that's probably a good thing. Our generation is apologetically self-aware, maybe apologetically self-absorbed. Postmodernism is here to stay, or at least a fad that we have to endure. It continues to chirp and chip. It chips away at truth claims and chirps aloud a pluralist message. Such chipping and chirping is why we need meetings like this one to think about apologetics in fresh ways. But enough of this garbage. What's the good news? Yeah, it's garbage. First, I'm encouraged because we're still digging. The last word... Maybe my computer died. There we go. The last word on the matter of archaeology in the Bible has not yet been said. Far from it. Every summer, many excavation teams sponsored by universities take to the field in the biblical world. In a less seasonal way, governmental agencies such as the Israel Antiquities Authority and the Jordanian Department of Antiquities are working. And these agencies are necessary given the robust expansion of roads and buildings and houses and rail lines. You can't dig a hole in the old world without hitting something. Antiquities must be mapped and excavated before they are covered again by concrete and asphalt. And if you're afraid of all the archaeological sites disappearing, let me tell you, first of all, you shouldn't be too worried. While all the remains of the past are limited in quantity, admittedly, we're not pressing the boundary at the moment. In fact, back in 1989, when I was working at the site of Tel Dan, I asked Avraham Biran, the father of Israeli archaeology in many ways, I asked Biran to guess how much of the site he had dug. At the time, he had been working at this 50-acre site for more than 30 years. And in that 30 years, many wonderful things had come up out of the ground. A mud brick gate from the time of Abraham. A high place from the time of Jeroboam. A metal foundry from the time of the judges. And of course, we probably are all familiar with that stone that had the name of David inscribed on it. But how much of the site had been excavated? I asked Biran, and Biran scratched his head and then replied, probably about 4%. Now think about that for just a second. Everything that we know about the archaeology of Tel Dan is based on a sample size of 4%, dug over the course of 30 years. Now, given the riches of that 4%, can you imagine what the other 96% may hold? Oh, and by the way, the next time somebody says in your ear, archaeology has proved that such and such doesn't exist, you know, the old negative discovery argument, realize it might just be a sampling problem. There's a lot to dig, and I'm encouraged because we're still digging. I'm also encouraged because we're still thinking. Now, methodologically, we've come a long ways in the first 100 years of study. We know what a tell is. We know how tells form. New thinking is currently being directed at how tells erode and how they churn. Other techniques of analyzing and dating ceramic remains are making it possible to move beyond relative chronology offered by typical analyses, moving in the direction of absolute dates. On the theoretical side, There is movement afoot to develop fresh approaches to the relationship of Bible and archaeology. This new biblical archaeology is being pursued by some very bright people who understand that the paradigm established by Albright was a great start, but one that needs to be adjusted. These folks are talking about new biblical archaeology, one that takes seriously the claims of the text and yet allows for things like literary concerns. We tend to only hear the howls of the critics, recognize that there are other people out there talking too. Third and finally, I'm encouraged because of the advance of technology. It allows us to do things today that the founding fathers could only imagine. Now, I know, I risk sounding like a positivist here, but it's amazing to witness just how the field has changed in the last 15 years. For several seasons, I worked as a surveyor and as a mapper. Look at that very young face. Ooh. In the 1990s and 2000s, we used dumpy levels, theodolites, measuring tapes, bubble levels, and strings. We had a plus or minus of 10 centimeters or more wherever we went, and it was usually more because the wind was blowing. All that stuff is gone. And today we use satellite technology that's offering a plus or minus of 10 millimeters. 10 millimeters. Everything is digitally recorded and 3D mapping is routine. The technology of ground-penetrating radar has been around for a little while now, but it's been of limited use in the rocky tells of the Bible lands. Cutting-edge technologies are replacing this stuff as new approaches dubbed cyber archaeology are being developed. I don't think anybody is doing this better right now than Tom Levy out at the University of California at San Diego. I was talking to some of you guys from San Diego land. You need to go talk to Tom. Tom is blowing everybody's brains out. Tom Levy. Tom Levy, if he put his mind to it, could probably put a capsule on Mars with all the engineers he has behind him out there in the archaeological field. Huh? L-E-V-Y, Tom Levy.
You say that
UCSD? Uh-huh, yes he is. And you can look him up on the, he's got a website on this cyber stuff, which is just incredible. Tom's team in Jordan has already blown apart ideas about copper mining, as one example in the ancient world. At one time, the critics used to say the Edomites were a very late thing. And Tom has now demonstrated that's not the case at all. It goes all the way back to the late Bronze Age. All that is being blown apart. But back to technology. We also, in the old days, we used to carry reams of paper and notebooks into the fields. And all of that had to be copied and collated and sorted in order to make sense of it after the fact. But today, those field notebooks are being replaced by electronic devices and software that allows for the integration, immediate integration, between fields and with photographs and with the maps. Brother, we live in a brand new digital world. Future reporting of field work will likely be moved to the internet, where all this information will be easier to access than ever. So I'm encouraged, right, for the future of biblical archaeology. We're still digging. We're still thinking, and we're still innovating. It's not dead. It's not even close. Oh, yeah. But there's one other reason why I'm encouraged, too. And that's because I believe that God is still the Lord of history and that his work is visible to those of us who look. Thank you very much.
Question and answer, I assume.
Yes. Only if I can't run fast enough. Go ahead. Yes, sir.
So what's the, how did this guy you're referencing a lot, Bill Deaver?
Yes.
You know, what led to his spiritual drift, if you will? How would I sum that up?
He graduated from Lane. Are you familiar with his story, Bob?
His dad was a missions prof there.
His dad was a missions prof.
Yeah.
He talks about in his college days how he used to sing in the gospel quartet, you know, with the matching search, and he laughs about it. He kind of jests about that now. He grew up in an atmosphere of faith. He went away to seminary at Harvard, and in the course of his time at Harvard, kind of drifted out of all of that. It's amazing when he goes to these national conventions and things and he speaks. I mean, he's mesmerizing to listen to. And if you watch him and how he talks and moves, and you say, that man was trained in homiletics. Unlike most archaeologists who are real bumblers up front, you know, this guy knows how to talk. So he's got all that baggage behind him, but for reasons that are beyond me, he's rejected all of that. He's walked away from that. Considers himself today to be kind of Jewish. He considers himself secular Jew, even though he's not Jewish, but he adopts that perspective. But A to B, I don't know, and I have not yet had the courage to ask him straightforwardly. I suppose I should one time. I don't know. Does that help?
Yeah.
Is this mic on? Yeah. In a public forum?
Probably not asking him.
In a public forum, that's right. Yeah.
You know, pendulums tend to swing.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering if it's possible that these skeptics and critics might just finally get bored of the whole thing and leave the field to believers again at some point. Do you think there's any chance of that?
Any chance of that? I don't think so, no. I mean, it's possible, I suppose. Anything's possible. But
they got too much interest in defending their pluralistic view.
Well, I don't really think they're attempting to defend the view. It's a study, and you know, they would consider themselves, they're the objective ones in all of this. We're not fighting anybody. I think that's what you'd hear from their lips anyway. But yeah, I suppose it's possible. They're certainly open to those of us who want to. Many of them are open to those of us who ask biblical problems, biblical questions. And we're free to play among them, but we will not dominate the agenda, the agenda anymore. Yeah, unfortunately. I don't know. Yeah, yeah.
So I do a lot of lessons for college.
Yeah. Well, resource-wise, you know, everything is on the net these days. I mean, that's probably, yeah, and that's the problem. How do you sort through it? I guess you have to find some credible witnesses up there, and there are some. There are some that are out there. I have a lot of respect for a guy named Bryant Wood, Associates for Biblical Research. I think is his ABR. If you look them up. Bryant Wood not only excavates, he's involved with excavations in what we call the West Bank or Palestine, but he also tags a lot of other people and brings their stuff in. So look up ABR, Bryant Wood. That just immediately comes to mind. His interests would be very similar to yours. And there are others. I could send you a list. I try to tag them on my own website. Although my website that I do is more directed toward just telling stories and having fun. I'm not really trying to give people the latest and greatest discovery.
Yeah, it's a fine line because
yeah.
I don't want to direct people to pioneers because I'm talking to college students.
Right.
And they
right.
Want to see baloney, you know?
Right.
But at the same time, you don't want to discourage people's faith because we we believe we already have truth, and so you don't want to send them to a completely, you know, non-faith-based area
right.
where they, you know, make claims or, you know, out there kinds of things that
right.
they're not going to agree with.
Right. Well, start with Bryant's work and see if that doesn't help. And you can email me, and I've got stuff at home that I could send you as well, or connections, links. Yeah, there's a question.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of ignorance with regards to the whole archaeology field.
We're all amateurs here.
Even in light of this recent election, just this whole not involving yourself in foolish arguments kind of thing. And and again, pardon my ignorance. Please correct me. Anybody in the room? Don't go. But you've got these scientists, people, these archaeologists that are coming in it from, as you say, their own behavioral perspective.
Right.
Like kind of the opposite of the positivism, where he was saying truth is just going to reveal itself because we're all going to be unbiased. Mm. And so now you're going, everybody's biased. I mean, that's who we are. But as the Christian archaeologist going in there to, as you said, which was said beautifully, to just kind of affirm a truth that already is within you, it seems like when you've got all these other people, if the goal is a truth, even if they're not looking from a biblical truth, but they're trying to reveal truths about cultures and people and relationship, can it just be this many advice? You know, can it just be this we're all gleaning? Now we've got funding that may not be there for the biblical guys, mm-hmm. but it's there because there's this other kind of interest. Can't we all be gleaning together, and maybe foolish arguments come up because somebody's picking a fight, but that as the Christian, and I know it's just as hard as an archaeologist as it is as a Christian, to sometimes stay centered,
mm-hmm.
just as Jesus just stayed centered regardless of the anger or the hatred or the lack of belief or the skepticism. It wasn't his job to prove.
Mm-hmm.
It was just his job to be. So if you're just being in that space that's just centered, that if someone is offering, if a truth is revealed, does it matter?
Well, let me just kind of lean into what you're saying, and I don't want to take it in another direction, but I think it's important for us to realize that archaeology, some might even say archaeology is not even a discipline, that archaeology is just one tactic for looking at the ancient world, and that a biblical archaeologist or a Hindu archaeologist or a New York City archaeologist, I don't know, whatever label you want to call it, no matter what that label is, the work that they do is going to provide the same information, you know, in the end. And what makes biblical archaeologists different is not that they have biblical archaeology tools, you know, there's not like some super Bible, you know, with a zapper gun on it, but I mean that we are all looking for this data. What makes biblical archaeology, and I continue to believe that it's a valid discipline, what makes biblical archaeology biblical is the person that's standing on the other side of this data and is casting, here's how we're going to read it, right? Here's how we read it as a Christian. Here's how I read the data. And so it's not that archaeology itself has this kind of leaning, but the biblicist is going to be interpreting that data in a specific way. That's I think an important note to make. And so as biblicists or as Christians, we can look at the data sets from any number of digs, you know, and say, well, here's how that might relate to the Bible that somebody else is not noting. Did I twist you any? I don't know. Okay. That's okay. I appreciate your...
I mean, I'm trying to hear what you're saying, and maybe that will settle something different.
Maybe I'm not kicking it out very well.
Maybe, like I said, maybe I'm just coming from a more, like a too simple...
No, I don't think so.
Minded.
We all are, as you say, in this age of elections, we're all kind of super sensitive to this arguments and air stuff. Yeah, I hear you. Is interpretive,
that's
right?
Now, are we at a point now? Like, does the field of archaeology still use the Bible in terms of where we want to go? like, is it used at all at this point as any kind of a guide of, you know, the Bible talked about something here, there, or wherever. Let's go check there.
Right.
Or is that kind of gone now? And
I think that depends on who you're talking to.
Okay.
You know, some do, some don't.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This conference is supposedly on history, archaeology, and Christianity. And where do you think history and archaeology interface? You know, history has to do with documents and you know, these kinds of things and inscriptions. And, where do they interface, and how do you see that interface going?
Wow.
Because we're talking about physical stuff here. And
right.
History is not just physical stuff. It's people writing things.
Well, maybe one way to approach that is to step back and say, well, we've got two data sets here. We've got, you know, literary data, you know, or inscriptions, and these sorts of
Tacitus
things.
Tacitus writes something. That's a completely different thing than archaeology.
A different order of data than wheels and buttons, you know. And one of the differences between these two data sets is that when Tacitus says, well, the reason this happened is because such and such, we can access his intention. You know, we can draw intentionality right out of the text itself. And that's so much more difficult to do, you know, with the mute data. You know, what is the intention here? The data does not have an opinion. It doesn't have a voice of its own. Only the voice, you know, we have to read between the lines, so to speak. So maybe as you know, as I think with you about history, and you know, it would be helpful to talk about those two different sorts of data. And right now, where things are right now, is that this intentionality stuff is being pulled off the table by the postmodernists, who say, this is invalid because it has opinion in it, and this is more objective because it doesn't, which is just ironic beyond the pale, in my opinion.
Because the Bible is an historical document. It's obviously not an archaeological document.
Right.
It's clearly an historical document, and so our job is to assess it as a historical document, mm-hmm. not as an archaeological document, and yet we're talking about archaeological evidence. And
right.
I don't know if these people know how to talk to each other, historians and archaeologists. Do they ever sit down and have discussions about where they interact and how they, or do they never even sit in the same room? I'm just curious.
Well, it's funny. Remember, I pointed out
on the other side of the campus also.
I pointed out in 1995, Biblical Archaeology, the magazine changed its title. The same, within a year or two of that, the meetings, the national meetings of, you know, the clubbies, we always used to get together in the same city at the same time, same place. In fact, you could go this side of the hallway and get one lecture, this side of the hallway and get another lecture. What happened in the late 1990s is that the archaeologists decided to have their own meeting, different time. So it's not even... The archaeologists and the historians and the biblical studies people are not even sitting in the same room anymore. Yeah, I mean, we're not sitting down at the same table, apart from just a few, you know, a few guys here and there.
You think they could inform each other? You think they would want to inform each other?
Yeah, it would be nice.
Biologists don't talk to chemists, and you know, that's... Yeah,
yeah, you know that world far better than...
So that's what I've been talking about.
Yeah.
It's that same idea.
Yeah. Because we can't agree on what the data set is. We can't agree on what's relevant. I mean, that's part of the problem.
Can we all just listen to each other and then do
the I hear you.
Can we all just listen to each other and then go, okay, what's resonating? I mean, once truth comes out, I feel like sometimes truth is just truth and you know it's truth, like gravity. You know what I mean? There's certain truths that when they come out, they're just
truth.
That's really simple minds.
One would think so. Even that, what you just said right there, is not true among all these people. You have postmodernism, you got modernism and everything, and so.
Right, but as a Christian with the truth already, isn't there a resonating that when another truth comes from somebody else, then maybe it throws you off a little bit because it wasn't in yours, but then you realize, and then now you've grown. You've deepened the depth of understanding of God, and do you know what I mean? Like, it might rock you at first, but because we are the truth owners, We don't know all truth. We don't own the full market on it, but we're open to it. We want the light to continue to shine in every area.
I like...
So somebody over here brings up an area that shines a light. Who cares where the guy's coming from? He just shined this awesome light, and now I'm richer.
I like
what
you say.
We have another talk starting in 10 minutes, so we'll shut things down here. Thank you, Mark.
Very
welcome. Okay, good. So, Brian, why are you there? Brian, doesn't really matter. Brian, all right, it's official. Brian's over there. Okay, great. Ooh, that was shocking. I did, slightly. It's just a fairly dry air today.
What's going on here?
There we go.